Good morning. Thanks for listening in to Downtown Crossroads. This is show number 3, and our purpose in these shows is to establish a deep context for development in downtown Los Angeles. And we're really honored here today. We have as our guest the former chief of staff for Jose Huizar in the 14th District, a Princeton graduate, Anna Kubis. And she'll be answering most of the questions on the show. And before we get to that, I just want to say that we're really trying hard to make some sense out of different issues. And probably, if we have a chance, we'll bring up the drug war again on this program. And the fact that it doesn't seem to work, and most of the casualties are Mexican. I brought this up with our first guest, Sandy Richards, and she felt that a lot of work needed to be done in that area, and we'll get back to that later. We're also going to have a call-in guest, Tony Quintero. He's head of the U.S. Latina Chamber of Commerce, and he'll be sharing the podium with Anna. But now we want to get to our guest here. And we want to ask her just a few questions about her own life before we get into the politics. So why don't you let us know about that? Like, where did you grow up? What was your early life like?
Thank you, Ed. It's an honor to be here. You're such a great friend and one of the downtown greats, I believe. So thank you for having me, and thank you for doing the show.
Wow, I should stop right here. That was incredible.
Downtown is a thriving community with a lot of residents, and it has a bright future. And that's what I love about the city. That's what I love about this country. I came as an immigrant from El Salvador when I was 10 years old. My family and I were escaping the civil war in El Salvador. Mm-hmm. And this country is great. This city is great. As many of you know, I recently ran for Los Angeles City Council for the 9th Council District, which includes the area of LA Live, Staples Center, USC, the Coliseum, and South Central Los Angeles. It was an amazing experience. It was my first time running for office. And only in this country would it be possible for someone like me that came here as an immigrant from El Salvador to be able to be a top contender for Los Angeles City Council.
That's fantastic. You know, I think you should tell us a little bit about that race and give us some background.
Well, a couple of years ago, the city went through a redistricting process. And during that process, we looked at the demographics of Council District 9, myself and a few community leaders in South LA, and we noticed that the district had changed quite a bit. The demographics are such that District 9 is about 80% Latino by population. The voter registration there is about 50%. There is still a very strong African-American presence there in terms of residents and voters. So I was asked by a group of community leaders called the Latino Coalition to run in that seat about a year and a half ago.
Let's try to put that into context for our listeners who may not be in LA or in California. And we're talking about a district that was heavily African-American for years during the development of Central Avenue and much later. And these are the changes that we're concerned about in our show. So please continue.
So the district has gone through a demographic shift, and I had the privilege of being supported by former Councilwoman Rita Walters, who was the councilwoman of the 9th District prior to Councilwoman Jan Perry. And so really my campaign was a coalition campaign. The theme and the goal was always to unite Latinos and African Americans in that district to fight for what I called back to basics, making sure the alleys were clean, the streets were clean, that we had the access to City Hall that other council districts get.
That's interesting you should mention that, because we've spoken on our show about it isn't just that area. The entire city has problems with its alleys being not repaired, impossible to drive in. And all over the city, all over downtown, we've had these business improvement districts develop since the 80s because the city didn't have the money to maintain the alleys and especially security in the area.
Yes. So because of the continual cutbacks in city resources, we have a situation that the city itself can't take care of the basics that the city is in charge of. And many people know the city of LA has a $7 billion budget. The majority of that budget goes to police and fire. It's about 70%. So there's not a whole lot left for what I call the basics, which is what public works, all of the departments, the Bureau of Engineering, Bureau of Street Services, those are the departments that can take care of the basics. And so there's not enough to go around. So that's why you saw an emergence of business improvement districts where businesses choose and vote to tax themselves to provide services for cleaning up the streets, the alleys, and public safety.
That's great. You know, we'll be inviting the heads of different business improvement districts to visit our show once we finish this foundational series of looking deeply into these issues. You're really running ahead of me here, and I feel like I don't even have to ask questions, but
Tell
us some more about that election. Tell us a little bit more about the election, and what was the turnout like as opposed to the registration numbers?
So there's about 75,000 voters registered in Council District 9. In both the primary and the general election, only about 12,000 turned out. So you're talking about between 10 and 15% turnout. It's one of the lowest turnouts in the city of Los Angeles. And I saw why. I went door to door and most people said to me, well, you're the first candidate that's come to my door and I've lived here for 30 or 20 years. And that was Latino and African American voters alike. So there's a lot of disenchantment and disengagement between the people of the 9th district and their government. Many times I had to explain to people, well, what does a city council member do? What does an assembly member do versus a senator versus a county supervisor? And I'm actually getting together with a few friends, supporters during my campaign to establish a group that will go to door and promote civic engagement. It's what I called Government and Politics 101, going door to door and explaining to people what are the different levels of government, why is it important to vote? Because what we know is the more that voters are engaged in their communities, the more reaction and response you get from your government, whether it's the city level. We see this on the West Side. We see this in the West Valley where there's high voter turnout, high voter participation. And then you see their government responding. The streets are cleaner. The alleys are cleaner. So it's what I call a catch-22 for the people of South LA. If they don't vote, if they don't get involved, you'll see a continual lack of attention to the basic needs of that council district. And what I want to say, too, is the election was held. There was a winner. Curran Price won. He's a council member. I really hope that he will work with the community to roll up his sleeves, to clean up the district, to really engage people, because that election was very costly for him. He ended up spending combined about $2 million. I ended up raising about $500,000.
Thanks so much. We'll get back to that election. And I want to ask you what it's like to run in a district where the stem of it is really a minority community, different minority groups, but rather low income, and then the attachment is this wealthy part of downtown. But we'll get back to that. We have our first caller. Welcome to the show. Who's calling?
Hello. Hi. This is Tony Quintero. Ed, do you hear me?
Yes, we can both hear you.
Great, great. Hi. I'm enjoying your show, and I'm glad to be on the phone with you. I think you're doing a good service, and taking on some very interesting and challenging topics. So it's good to hear your show's going well.
That's fantastic. What we're going to do is have you on the line also as a second participant. And I know you have so much to say. And we also want to kind of get to the beginning of Anna's interview. And then we'll have you respond to similar questions concerning your own background. Does
sure,
that work for
great.
You?
I'm standing by.
Okay, fantastic. So I wanted to ask you, we have Tony on the line, and just we want to remind our guest that he is a businessman that has been very successful, but continue to be engaged in the issues affecting his community. Now we want to get back to Anna. What about this business of having a district that's comprised on one end of mostly minority communities, rather lower income than other parts of the city, and to have that combined with the arena, which is a huge project of the billionaire Philip Anschuss and has a tremendous impact downtown? How were you able to appeal to both constituencies?
Well, what I heard often going door to door was people did not want their elected official to focus too much on downtown and the developers, that they wanted attention paid to the basic needs of the district. So that was one thing that I heard. And number two, the creation of the jobs at Staples Center, LA Live, and hopefully the future NFL stadium, although that future is up in the air, really should result in the community getting jobs out of those ventures. So I know the city council, when approving the concept for the NFL stadium, required a local hiring ordinance. So those are the two primary concerns of the constituents. On the one hand, making sure that the focus wouldn't be so much on downtown. And the other is, what can we require of these large developments so that they hire locally, so that the community doesn't get left out of jobs, because that's the number one concern for that community is jobs.
You know, developers and businesses often complain that California leads the way in putting regulation on businesses and extra demands. Do you have any sense about that? We do pioneer in a lot of areas of the environment and worker safety. Is that a problem, or is that a good example?
Well, the problem is you have a bureaucracy. So whether it's City Hall or the state government, the bureaucracy is not that friendly. So even though the regulation itself may not be bad, it's the treatment and the slowness of the process that I think deters businesses from locating in LA and wanting to stay in California. And I am a big fan of the city creating an economic development strategy that's focused on customer service, that's focused on friendliness and a quicker pace to the needs of the business community. That's really the number one issue. I haven't really heard too many businesses complain too much about regulation. It's about the bureaucracy and the red tape that is the biggest concern. And so I would hope that, especially with Mayor Garcetti, who seems to really get this and understands the back to basics theme, is how do we create a city government that is responsive to the needs of the business community and also to residents about what we need, basic things, courtesy and good customer service and quick responses, as opposed to a whole bunch of red tape. That's what residents have been getting. That's what businesses have been getting. So I'm a fan of reinventing government, not necessarily undoing the regulations, but making sure that the door is open for business and that the red tape and the slowness of the bureaucracy goes away.
Wow. You know, before we get to a question that both you and Mr. Quintero can take a shot at, I wanted to ask you, you've had experience in Sacramento.
Mm-hmm.
What What is it with Sacramento? Is it a different problem than LA City of responsiveness and dealing with business? Because you hear more complaints about Sacramento, really, than you do about Los Angeles. Can you shed some light on that, on the differences between the two?
Yeah, and what I find interesting, Ed, is that you look at Los Angeles City Council, and I would say 5 or 6 of the current members are former Sacramento lawmakers. So I think the LA Times coined LA City Hall as Sacramento South. So I don't know whether that's a good thing for the residents of the city of LA. What I see is the same issue, and I worked in Washington, D.C. also, and that's the issue of red tape and bureaucracy. The difference between Los Angeles City Hall and Sacramento, the state legislature, is really City Hall is where I call the rubber hits the road, the nitty gritty. This is what people, as they walk out of their door, expect from their government. Sacramento tends to be more removed, so there's not a lot of interaction between the legislators and their constituency, unlike in LA City Hall, where that's your job as a council member on a daily basis to deal with basic issues that constituents have. From the trash not being picked up to stray dogs running around to dirty alleys. So there is, at different levels of government, a more disengagement. And that's the case, too, at the federal level, where most people can't think of, well, what does a federal agency do that impacts my life, for example? Whereas in the city, your daily life is impacted by what's happening in City Hall. Police and fire, local libraries, parks, public works. And that's really why I ran for city council, is because I believe that that is the closest that the people have to their government, to their elected officials.
Oh, thank you. Were you influenced, and we're going to give Tony a chance to answer these same questions, were you influenced by one person or a religious leader or a parent that got you involved in politics? How did it happen? Not everybody chooses that path.
You know, for me, it was my grandmother. I was born in El Salvador. I was mostly raised by my grandmother. She died when I was 10 years old. She was in our little small town in El Salvador, a community leader, a religious leader. I would actually open the door to our house, and there would always be someone there who needed help, needed food, needed clothing, needed money. And my grandmother, even though we were very humble, very poor, would give whatever she had, whether it was food in the pantry or whatever money she had or clothing. And I remember when she died, when I was 10, the entire town came out to her funeral. And that's when I knew that's what I wanted to do in my life, was to help the community, to be like her, because I saw how she was kind and giving and loving, and how when she died, everyone came out to pay their respects. So,
wow.
So that was when I was 10 years old.
The orange didn't fall far from the tree, or in your case, the naranja. hey, Tony, what is it that led to your interest in politics, and why do you maintain an activism even though you're a successful businessman?
Well, that's a good question, Ed. I think that I grew up with leaders like Robert Kennedy and John Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Cesar Chavez. But the most influential of all was my dad, who was undocumented, went to fight for the United States in World War II, survived 5 of the most deadly campaigns in the Pacific, and returned with a Bronze Star for valiantry in combat, yet had to face discrimination and prejudice like he'd never seen. And my parents had lived in Mexico. But with the opportunities in this country, and having served during World War II, my dad felt we should stay. But we grew up with a dad that was very, very I would say, strong and committed to improving conditions in this country for Latinos. There is nothing like having contributed as much as he did for this country and to be treated like a second-class citizen, to be discriminated against. People forget that my dad grew up through the period when it was legal to segregate Latinos in schools. And it was brave leaders like Roberto Alvarez, who was the lead plaintiff in the Alvarez versus Lemon Grove, that had the courts declare that it was unconstitutional. Yet we still had another major battle that involved Orange County. Westminster School District was sued because it was discriminating and putting the Mexican children in separate schools. So long before Brown versus Board of Education, Latinos have been fighting these battles, and I think my dad was just incredibly influential. And I had four brothers, five of us all together. We all went to college. My brother and I both went to, I know Anna's from Berkeley. We both went to Bolt Hall, graduated, both of us, and have a family, and all my dad's grandchildren have all completed college or have PhDs or doctorates. And that's amazing when we are suffering here from discrimination and hatred, prejudice, telling us that we can't live here, that we have to deport 11 million people who are here, including young children who came here not even knowing that they were illegal or what that meant, who are contributing significantly to the society.
And you know, Tony, I want to get people know Anna a little better than they know you, for sure. And one of the, I want to kind of establish your commonality with the rest of our listeners. And one of the most amazing things about you to me has nothing to do with these issues, which is I'm a broker, and most brokers stay as brokers. So we end up working for the owners, one might say. But you, in contrast, went ahead and became an owner yourself. And you ended up owning shopping centers.
Regional malls. That's right.
Right. That's even bigger.
Right.
What can you tell us about, what did that feel like, first of all, to become an owner when previously you just had to work for them? And what drove you to that? Is it the same education and the same parenting?
Well, you know, actually, talking about parenting, you know, what drove me to that was that my first memory was living in tents across the street from a big property that later on became a regional mall. So when I was in high school, I worked in the mall, and I liked it so much, I later on decided to start buying them. And it was a thrill. It was incredible that now I was the owner, and we bought a portfolio of regional malls. It was a great idea at the right time, right when the crisis hit, and we were dealing with the banks taking back lots of properties, particularly the regional malls. We found that the problem was that they were basically stripping down, abandoning malls, taking the good tenants out if they were in ethnic areas. And they didn't want Wall Street to perceive their companies, and their major five companies in this country. They didn't want to be perceived as buying ethnic malls, as they called them. So we came in with a plan to re-tenant them with tenants that were relevant to the particular ethnic community, which national mall owners have never done or never did before. And therefore, yeah, I was the first owner of Latino, or of regional malls, the first Latino to own a portfolio of regional malls in this country. It was thrilling. I'd fly into town, the staff would take me out, I'd be escorted through the mall with the security staff, and everybody would wonder, who is that guy?
And wow, we'll have to keep, Anna's starting to look like she might be interested in you, so we'll have to.
Yeah, but
he saw your picture.
As a friend, of course.
He saw your picture on Facebook, so watch out. That sounds great. You're saying that. I want to give Anna a chance to comment on what you said, but you're saying that it's kind of the same thing that led you to become a successful businessman. You wanted your community to participate in the action and not be excluded. Am I right?
Exactly. Exactly. There's, I think it all begins with economic, then social and political empowerment. But until Latinos learn to do business together, we're going to get further and further behind. And that's why it's amazing what we have done and the dramatic improvements we've seen in our communities.
What do you think about that, Anna, like the path he took towards engagement?
That's great because, again, it's a testament that to the American dream, that it's alive and well, whether you choose politics, whether you choose business. And I agree with him because we need economic empowerment in order to have social and political empowerment. In LA, it took a long time to have a Latino elected official, and it's really been only in the past 2 decades that we've seen an increase in the number of Latinos, obviously to reflect the demographics of the city and the state, and not to the exclusion of other groups. But as they say, the founding members worked on a premise that there's no taxation without representation. So that's what we're talking about.
Yeah,
well,
you know,
that's really a good point, Anna. And, you know, it reminds me that I have to announce that formally this month, is the first time in the history of the state of California, well, going back to, and that's my, another one of my big arguments, is since the invasion of Mexico in 1847 and the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in 1848, Latino population has now become the largest ethnic group in the state of California, which is really amazing, and that just happened. The demographics are there, and it's now the Latinos are the largest ethnic group in this state, larger than Anglos.
No, what that doesn't
also,
sound
even
too...
Even more astounding, what I have to tell you, really, really, and that happened this year, for the first time in the history of the state of California, Latinos are going to college in greater number than Anglos. This past year, 69% of Latino high school graduates went to college. Anglos was 68%. When I left law school, only 2% of the nation's students were Latino. Today, over 20% of the college students are Latino.
Wow, that sounds like it might cut into my commission. I mean, you know what they say, Jesus saves, Moses invests. So, I mean, I just want to keep things on a little bit of a lighter note. I had the honor years ago to work on the sale of the Banks Huntley building to MALDEF. Mm-hmm. This was 20 years ago. This was in the middle of the battle over Proposition 187. And MALDEF, mm-hmm. under President Antonio Hernandez, was leading mm-hmm. the fight against Prop 187.
Right.
She said to me at that time, quote, all we want is what everybody else wants, period. Now, that was 20 years ago. Has it happened or has it not? I'm going to let Anna answer that and then Tony.
I believe in terms of politics, it's gotten better. It's not where we should be. If you look at just focusing on Los Angeles, you have 4 members that are Latino. It's not half of the city council to reflect the population, but we've got a long ways to go to ensure that the Latino population actually votes and is registered to vote. An interesting thing about that MALDEF building, and when you said that, I didn't know that you were part of that, because I had an internship in that building right before we got moved out when it got rehabbed. And that's when I met Antonia Hernandez, and I still to this day look up to her. She really is a role model. But I worked in that building as an intern on 6th and Spring. So what a great cosmic connection here that you were involved
right.
in helping them acquire the building, because now it's a nonprofit center. They have MALDEF there and other nonprofits. I ended up working there 20 years later for the Youth Policy Institute, which is located there on the 10th floor. Anyway, I have this special place in my heart for that building. That's I wonderful. Wanted to say that.
No, I feel that way about her.
I have to say that I do, too, having not only have I had the pleasure of working with Ed Rosenthal in the past on major real estate transactions, but I was on the board of directors of MALDEF when I was only 25 and was also in the building when I was a consultant to the Latino Chamber of Greater Los Angeles.
That's so great.
So I know the building well, and it has a lot of history.
And to get to my question, are we there? Or I noticed a lot has happened in those 20 years since the MALDEF deal, but what's your perspective on where Hispanics are in California and, if possible, in L.A. compared to 20 years ago?
Well, let me just say that fact is that we still have 40% of adult Latinos do not have a high school diploma. We are still suffering in for politics. Even in politics, where we made significant changes today, there are 30 Latinos working in the White House, and we have 21 Latinos in our state legislature. When I left law school, there were two Latinos in the assembly. So we've made dramatic improvements, but we're halfway there. And it's going to happen because of our burgeoning population, our commitment to civil rights, and our willingness to work together as Latinos to improve our conditions. That's the big difference we have. We have become a movement in a community that has that. Although a lot of diversity of opinions, we are very united on certain issues like immigration and many other political reforms that need to happen.
What are some of those diversity of opinions you're alluding to?
Well, I mean, we have people like Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, who are, I would consider, Tea Party Republicans, who really don't represent the views of most Latinos, not Latinos in California, and very close to or pushing the idea that they should be the next president, that because they're Latino, that they're in line, and it's almost assumed that they should be considered. And I don't think they represent the views at all of the Latino community or most of the Latino community. And diversity is, some people think we need to do it by business, and some people think we need to make changes by being extremely involved politically and having a very strong voice. In fact, both of those, the inside and the outside game, are the ones that are going to make the difference. We will have people moving up the ladders, the corporate ladders and corporate boards. But we're going to also have organizations like MALDEF and Chambers of Commerce who are fighting for equality and justice for our community.
What do you think about that, Anna?
Well, obviously on a national level, you have the division of the Democratic versus the Republican parties, and Latinos are members of the Republican Party, and the issue of immigration has brought those divisions really to light. At the California level, most of the Latino electeds are Democrats, and the divisions that you see there are different cliques, different groups that have formed in the past 20 years in terms of who will have power. And what I see, and this is something you and I were talking about before the show started, is the lack of women being at the table and the creation of this boys network that continue to tap and fund other men to run for office. For example, in City Hall, there's one woman, one female council member, one female elected official in general, and it's Councilwoman Nuri Martinez, and I congratulate her because she ran a really good campaign. She ran against another woman, Cindy Montañez, a former assemblywoman, but you see also that in the state legislature, in the state assembly, in the state senate is... you see this very strong boys network, and I've seen that play out in the Latino community especially, that you don't have many of the Latino electeds wanting to mentor and support women to run for office, to replace them, or to be what I call to be on the bench, to be ready to tap, to be tapped and say, all right, you're up, you're next to bat, because that's how the boys network works. And so that is one area of concern that I have is, yes, Latinos have more political empowerment. It's not where we should be, and it's certainly not equal in terms of gender balance.
Please call in to comment on this discussion between Anna Kubis and Tony Quintero regarding issues facing Hispanic community in Los Angeles. The number is 800-893-9562. I just want to throw in my own perspective on that. I commented on my Facebook page today that basically my life is run by women. And we live in a male-dominated by female society. But I was just talking about myself because Sandy Richards had said, all my guests so far have been female. In fact, Tony, you're the first male we've had on the show.
Well, thanks.
But what I said was, yeah, it starts at the house with my wife and daughter bossing me around, and then my editor is a female, the publisher's a female, the person writing my forward is a female, and the woman running the business improvement district is a female. So obviously that's not the situation that Anne is talking about in the Hispanic community.
I need to remind you and Anna that the head of the largest political advocacy group in the country, NCLR, is run by a Latina. And actually, overall, I'm very impressed, very proud of our Latina women's organizations who have come on so strong and have been so effective. But I think what we really all agree on in the women and men's Latino groups is that we all are in this together. And that our differences don't separate us. Issues like immigration reform, 75% of this country wants it to happen. And here we are with a few screwballs in Congress that are holding up the whole thing, with everything from filibuster to statements like one made by Stephen King, Iowa congressman, that Latinos are not all valedictorians. In fact, most of them are carrying, have cantaloupe-sized calves because we're carrying 75-pound packs of marijuana across the desert. That's nothing more than a racist statement and a very poor argument against immigration reform. But that's the kind of thing we're up against, and in those issues, you can bet the Latino communities united together, women, men, Republicans, Democrats, independents. We really all want to be treated equally. We want civil rights, and we want justice for our people. We're done with discrimination and prejudice for our children. We do not want to see that in the next generation.
Well, he sounds too tough for the show. Well, let me just read to you. I'm just kidding. I want to bring it back to an L.A. context. And one of our most well-known politicians, Representative Karen Bass, Bass was quoted in the L.A. Times this week and is saying, quote, I am not optimistic that comprehensive immigration reform is going to be brought up in the House of Representatives anytime soon, said Bass. A member of the Judiciary Committee, which is hearing most of the immigration bills. Quote, the bills making their way through the House, I would not want to see go anywhere. They are very onerous. There's no pathway to citizenship in the bills. And then about Stephen King, she said, the Republicans who denounced King's statement share many of his positions, but express them differently. There is the crude and there is the sophisticated. At the end of the day, I think both opinions are pretty much the same in terms of the disrespectful viewpoint of immigrants. So that is not terribly encouraging. And on a personal level, what would you say to people like that? Because I really believe the only way to work with them is to reach out to them.
Yeah, I think it's clearly, you know, it's a matter of education, information. The more facts and information, I think clearer it makes the issue that it's just a part of this country that was based upon this concept of bring me your wretched, your poor, those people that that are really economic refugees, which is what is really happening, and the people coming from Latin America are economic refugees. Most of America was built on economic refugees immigrating to this country. So, and I think the stuff like Karen Bass's kind of a negative attitude is, if she's right, I can tell you it's only going to polarize us more, and I can tell you you're going to see not just 75% of people in favor of it. It's definitely going to drive people more in favor of it, and I think it's also going to unify the Latino community even more. And I think the Republicans will be making the worst mistake they've ever made, because you'll see the polls swing dramatically back to the position of immigration reform going through, being passed, and many of the issues that affect Latinos, like equal justice and freedom from discrimination, will start becoming much more viable, much more important.
And Ed, I'm very disappointed in Congresswoman Karen Bass, especially because her district has also gone through demographic changes, and it's majority Latino as well. And her comments are discouraging, because instead of playing a leadership role in telling her audience, and it, this came out of an immigration town hall that she had in her district, instead of saying to people, look, let's work together, let's fight to get immigration reform done, it was a very pessimistic attitude, almost basically saying, I'm not going to really work hard to make this happen. So it's disappointing to come from her as a leader. And for me, it's basic economic math, in that we have immigrants that work in the underground economy because they're undocumented. We have young people that go to school every day. We have and are valedictorians. We have a sector of our economy that, once we normalize their status, will contribute more to this economy, will help our budget crisis that we have at the city level, at the county level, at the state and the federal level. They are not a drain to those government agencies. They will actually increase revenues. Imagine all the business taxes that the city could get. Imagine the income tax and additional revenue that we could get by normalizing the status of people who are already here and are not going anywhere.
What about, isn't it true that these people already pay Social Security taxes, but sometimes it's under a false name, so they never get to claim it back?
Right.
The
money
goes right into the treasury.
And they never get anything in return.
The Urban Institute, you're talking about downtown in L.A., we are dealing with a situation where we're faced with constant misinformation and lies. It's been used as an economic argument, and basic thinking is that, or the argument is that we're draining the resources of this country because Latinos are coming here to have children and all that kind of stuff. Completely false. The Urban Institute, there in Los Angeles, did a study in L.A. County, and they found that for every dollar that Latinos who are undocumented receive in government resources, they pay into the system $4.56, more than 4.5 times what they receive. They're paying into the system. Yeah, some of it is Social Security numbers. Some people, they just don't file because they've used their Social Security number, and they don't file because they don't know how to deal with a tax return, and they're afraid they're going to get in trouble, all kinds of things. But the bottom line is, working people here, 95% of Latinos who are here undocumented are working. That's one of the highest employment ratios of any ethnic group.
So when they did that survey, did they include uses of emergency rooms in hospitals and things like that, which the Latino community uses?
Yeah, and it's probably lower than anyone else because they don't, they're afraid they're going to be arrested if they go in with an injury. And the thing is, it's nothing more than information. Latinos don't take Social Security. They go back to Mexico most of the time. They're here and they're healthy. They use very little of the medical resources that other people require. And it's just all misinformation. Contributing significantly, you forget that people like my father and thousands more, Latinos have more congressional medals of honor than any other ethnic group ever because of their willingness to die for this country. And we never get any credit for those things.
I think the bottom line is it makes economic sense for the country and all levels of government to ensure that there are people that can help us increase the revenue source for the services that we all need. Imagine in the city of LA, when we normalize the status of undocumented immigrants, what that would mean for revenues into the city of Los Angeles. And what that would mean for new voters. We could launch a voter registration program to ensure that those immigrants that become documented then become U.S. citizens. You know, I became a U.S. citizen when I was 19. My mom, at that time we were here legally, we had our green card. I came at the age of 10, and I remember my mom asking me, "Well, mija, what do you want for your 18th birthday?" And I didn't say I want clothes or shoes. I said, "Mom, I want to be a U.S. citizen so I could vote," because I realized I turned 18. It's our right to vote, but I couldn't vote yet. And so at the age of 19, I got sworn in as a U.S. citizen in the West Hall of the Los Angeles Convention Center. And it was one of the most amazing experiences of my life. There were thousands of people in that convention hall. And to this day, you see a lot of people going to West Hall to become U.S. citizens. So that's what we want, as you said, that Antonia said to you a while back, what everyone has, access to education, access to our government, because we are here to contribute, to make our lives better, to make this country better, to make the city better.
What do you feel is a way for minority communities to cooperate in getting a bigger piece of the pie? Because while these struggles over resources are taking place within minority communities, like, for example, in L.A., some African Americans feel they lose jobs or they lost businesses since Hispanics moved in. What is a way that those groups can cooperate together in order to achieve more for both? We've been talking about the Hispanic community as if it's the only minority community in L.A.
Well, Ed, it's very important that you understand that Latinos and African Americans have much more in common than they differ on. And the media, I've heard Fox News push this thing that the Mexicans and the blacks don't like each other, there's a lot of internal strife and all that kind of stuff. That's not true. And I think it's pretty hard to be Latino and not understand what blacks go through and the discrimination and prejudice they suffer every day. So the idea that we're not together is I think, something I really have to say. Latinos will not agree on that. And differences we may have are like very little compared to what we're on the same side about.
Well, I've taken that 733 bus down Venice Boulevard, and I've heard some comments from both communities at different times that would, you know, they don't exactly reflect the spirit of cooperation. So could you elaborate on that a little bit more? I'm saying it doesn't just come from Fox News. People themselves are difficult.
I'd say, you know, you're getting down to individual personality, one-on-one type, and I'm sure that whites have problems with whites and African-Americans have trouble with Hispanics and all of that. I think it's really, really dangerous to generalize or to say Latinos talk about blacks or vice versa. I don't think that's what's important. I think what's really important is we have a common issue. We both communities and all ethnic communities are fighting for to overcome the prejudice and discrimination. We've all come here just like all other ethnic groups in the history. As you know, I was a sociologist. The issue is we're coming here to overcome, and just like all the other ethnic groups, Latinos, African Americans, all of us are fighting for equality and justice and to overcome the prejudice and the racism. We have a lot in common, and the most important issues, those are the ones we're in common on.
Mainly economics, right? The minimum wage,
I think,
maybe?
We're talking about civil rights. We're talking about, we're talking about jobs. We're talking about employment, but we're talking about education. We're talking about the law and how we're treated. And I think that Martin Luther King, Cesar Chavez, they stood on the same ground, and they believed in the same thing, and they didn't talk about each other. That's really what it's all about.
And for me, walking door to door for a year, both African American and Latino households, what I realized, we're all in the same boat. Both communities were neglected. Both communities told me, you're the first person that knocks on my door, and I've lived here 20 to 30 years. That was both African American and Latinos. Both are neglected by their government, actually. That's what I realized at the local level. So we have that in common, that we are not taken into account, that we're neglected, that we don't have the same access to our government that we should. That was one. Now, the issue of competition for jobs came up quite a bit as I was campaigning between Latinos and African Americans.
So how did that get expressed?
So it would be asked directly, how will you ensure that we African American males especially have access to jobs? How would you ensure that not all the jobs go to Mexicans or Latinos? I would be asked that. And my answer to that is, look, if we work together to create more jobs for everyone, we wouldn't even be in that situation where we have to compete for the scraps, because that's the situation that South LA finds itself in. We're competing for the scraps because no one is locating their businesses there. And my platform was to turn that around, to spur economic growth and get clean tech jobs. For example, solar panels, manufacture solar panels, get an apprenticeship program with both Latino and African American men and women to install the solar panels. So the solution is, let's work together to create jobs for all. Let's not fight for the scraps, because that's what government is giving to both our communities right now.
Right. What I was thinking of, just so you both know, is that we live in a country where the income distribution keeps getting more and more skewed toward the wealthy and more away from lower income groups. And I was just hopeful of cooperation between minorities in that regard. You know, one policy issue that really annoys me is the drug war, and it heavily impacts both communities, Latinos and blacks. And the drug war, there was recently a demonstration in the Pueblo, you know, the original city downtown, and there was a group from Mexico meeting there, and they had a large turnout, and their whole purpose was to explain that the drug war is really fought in Mexico at the expense of Mexicans. They're the ones dying, and it's because of a U.S. consumption need and policy. And I wonder if either of you, I asked my first guest, Sandy Richards, whose church is actively involved trying to assist poorer communities around the world, what she thought about it. I wanted to ask you two about, what's your impression of the drug war in terms of its impact on your community?
Well, I just got to say that your so-called drug war is, it's caused over 30,000 deaths in Mexico. And but what's driving it is the guns in the United States. The guns are illegal in Mexico. They're coming from the United States. And the drug demand is from the United States. There would not be any cartel. There would not be any drug war if the United States wasn't such a consumer of drugs. So it suggests maybe the United States would want to do something about the consumption. Maybe we want to do more to avoid weapons coming from the United States into Mexico, and I think you'd see a dramatic change in the drug war. The new president of Mexico, Enrique Peña Nieto, has said that one of his biggest priorities will be the drug war. He's working with Obama, and I've met with him twice. He's sincere about it. You know, politics is politics, and there's so many people with their hands in the pot, but he's working on it, and I have faith that things will improve. But I also think that this is a problem that stems from the demand we have in this country, and legalization of marijuana would probably end all the cartels right there. They won't have anything to ship us because it will be legal. Things like that are things we should think about.
What about, do you think it's driven by contractors, security contractors, and weapons contractors that want to make money off the drug war, and they influence policy?
No, it's not security contractors. No, I don't think so. I think we're dealing with some illegal elements that are managing to get weapons into the country. That's what's happened.
It's a supply and demand. You have the Northern Hemisphere, U.S. and Canada, by the way, who are the consumers of the drugs. You have the Southern Hemisphere, South America, and then you have the thoroughways, Central America and Mexico. It's fascinating because if you look at the drug trade in Europe, you see the same phenomenon. The Southern Hemisphere, Africa, and the Southern Asian countries are the suppliers to the North, the consumers, Europeans, and those that live in the northern part of the hemisphere. So it's a global issue. And until you cut off the demand for the supply, we're going to continue to see the same problem.
That's right.
Okay. I wanted to ask Anna what it feels like to be a young Latina at this time period with all these things going on, with all the changes in America and in general. How does that feel for you to participate in a time like this here in Los Angeles?
I feel great. I know that in no other country, even in Europe or Mexico or El Salvador, would someone like me be able to be where I am, where I was the first in my family to go to college. I have a master's degree from Princeton. I had the privilege of running for office. I came so close to winning. And only in this country is it possible. And the American dream is alive and well, and it's up to me and you, Ed, and Tony, and everyone else who's listening to fight to make sure that it continues, because the greatness of this country we haven't even seen yet. And I'm excited to be in LA. I'm excited to be part of the process. I'm excited to have the education that I have because I know I wouldn't want to live anywhere else.
You know, I will give Tony a chance to comment on that. I feel the same way. I grew up in the projects in New York, and here I am out here, a successful investment broker. And I have a lot of fun bossing around a lot of wealthy people, actually. And it's great. I think that would be very difficult to accomplish anywhere else. And my partner grew up in a really poor part of England where they had no opportunity whatsoever post-World War II. And he feels the same way about the amazing opportunity here. I even think California is really the place to be. I don't think I could make inroads in the real estate business in New York the same way as I was able to do it in California. Here, anybody can call anybody. You could call any president of a bank, any developer, any investor. And that's just not what it's like in New York. This is even more open. I mean, this is the frontier of the frontier.
Absolutely.
What do you think about that, Tony? You're a fighter.
Yeah, well, I think L.A. is a great place, and it's going to continue to be the mecca for many new and promising people that are going to contribute a lot to improve our world. And I wanted to just drop to say that the issue, I see it, and it may be too profound for your show, is that...
Hey, what do you mean by that?
Well, I want to get to the bottom line. 50% of this country, more than 50% of this country, will be Latino in this century, in our near future. What does that mean? It means to me that maybe that's why people are so afraid of the Latino population. Because what happens if Latinos in power treat non-Latinos the way Latinos have been treated in this country? What, you know, could be going on? I mean, people may be thinking about that. Maybe that's why they're afraid. But I can tell you that if, speaking for myself, Latinos in power are benevolent people who care about humanitarian causes and care about human issues. We care about equality and justice, and I don't think we would ever do that. You know, if you think about it, why don't we have a fence and $60 billion spent? We're crying about the money here. Somebody's complaining we're using up an emergency room. To ask about $60 billion for a wasted fence, what, to appease some of the extremists that think that that's going to stop drugs or what, immigration? It's not going to stop anything. It's just a waste of money.
That's right. That's right. Fear-driven politics. But I'm saying that there are contractors involved promoting that are going to make money building it. That's what
yeah,
I was...
Well, of course. There's also people... Yeah, and Jan Brewer in Arizona has a bunch of contractors on her payroll that are making a lot of money because she's locking up so-called undocumented workers. There's a big money in that. There's those economic issues. But I think we really ultimately will stand behind our belief that this is a country that's going to stand behind its principles of equality and justice for all, and it will overcome. And it may be troublesome battles at times, but this country is moving forward.
Well, that sounds great.
And it's a great place for everyone.
That's a positive note for us to end the show on, and I hope we can have both of you back again on this show, Skid Row Studios. It'll be on a podcast on iTunes within a few days, and you can hear this wonderful discussion over again between Anna Kubis and Tony Quintero. Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Ed. Great show.
Thank you, Ed.
All the wayward wind is a restless wind.